Hi, thank you all for coming. And as Aaron said, I'm very happy to tell you today about how to do DMRG on bilayer graphing. So in the Zoom era, I think it's more important than ever that people ask questions to me because otherwise I don't know, I don't know what anyone's thinking. So yeah, please interrupt me, please ask me questions as they come to you. I'd like to talk for a minute about our team. We're led by our fearless leader, Mike Zelotel. Our compression expertise comes from Shangyu Cao. Our bilayer graphene knowledge comes from Nick Boltenick. Johannes Hauschild is our DMRG maestro. And it's really all brought together by Tomo, who is a fantastic grad student at Berkeley. And really, he should have been here giving this talk instead of me. Unfortunately, he had a family emergency. So, I'm going to break this into three parts. I will start with telling one way to simulate twisted bilayer graphene. Then I'll move on to a little bit on matrix product operators and compression. And I'll finish by talking about what we get out physics-wise from doing DMRG. So let's jump right in. Our subject for today is magic angle twisted bilayer graphene, and the essential idea is that you take two layers of graphene superimposed on top of each other and you twist them slightly. This will create the moray pattern seen on the right here. Can people see my mouse as a pointer?
I can see it at least, yes.
Okay, good. So this will create this moray pattern with a much larger moray unit cell than the graphene unit cell. And this results, at least at the certain magic angle, at extremely flat bands where the Coulomb scale is much larger than the kinetic scale, which suggests that the physics should be very strongly interacting and we could get very interesting correlated phases showing up there. And when this was measured in 2018 by the MIT group, they indeed found a variety of very interesting phases. So they found correlated insulators, quantum anomalous Hall insulators, and over time people have added more and more intriguing phases to that, of which the most exciting perhaps is superconductivity in a way that may have some parallels to the cuprates. So our goal for today is to take almost an ab initio perspective on this. We want to start with a microscopic model, making as few assumptions as possible, and use unbiased and non-perturbative numerics to find the ground state. So let's jump right in. What I'm going to use as my main tool today is density matrix renormalization group, or DMRG. And just to remind you or familiarize you, it is a non-perturbative method to find the ground state of 1D quantum systems. So for gapped systems, it's essentially exact, and for gapless ones, you can still make it arbitrarily accurate. Although this is normally a technique for 1D systems, you can upgrade it to two dimensions by working in an infinite cylinder geometry, as I've shown on the right here. So in this, you take a cylinder which is infinitely long in the x direction and then has a finite circumference of, say, 6 or 12 lattice sites. And by wrapping a 1D system around the cylinder in a snake-like pattern, you can convert this from a 2D cylinder to a quasi one-dimensional system where we can use DMRG. So by taking this special geometry, we can use DMRG even in 2D and get fairly close to the thermodynamic limit. To use DMRG, we need to encode our Hamiltonians and our states in a special way as matrix product operators and matrix product states respectively. And I'll tell you a little bit more about those later, but for now, the important thing is that they're parameterized by a bond dimension, D. So the more complex your Hamiltonian, the larger its bond dimension, the larger its bond dimension, the more memory it takes up, the longer it takes to find the ground state, et cetera, et cetera. So this will feature prominently in this work, and we'll come back to that. Okay, so DMRG is the tool we will use, and now I will tell you about our model. Our model will start off with a non-interacting part from the venerable Bistritzer-McDonald model, which is the standard model for non-interacting twisted bilayer graphene. And it goes like this. Let's look at the geometry first. As I said before, the graphene unit cell gets greatly enlarged to the Moray unit cell. So if you're in reciprocal space, the graphene Brillouin zone is much larger than the Moray or mini Brillouin zone, which I have pictured here. So if these are the graphene Brillouin zones, then the Moray one is going to be a small area near the edge here. And the model is defined in the continuum on top of the mini Brillouin zone as follows. You start with the monolayer graphene for the top layer, then add the bottom layer, and then allow interlayer tunneling. So this tunneling is actually parameterized. It can be different here in the AA stacking regions versus the AB stacking regions along the edge. And altogether, this gives us a quadratic Hamiltonian defined in the continuum over the mini Brillouin zone. So free fermions. Okay, that's the non-interacting part. To that, we add strong Coulomb interactions. So this is going to take the form of density-density interactions of electrons interacting, you know, as per normal with via Coulomb repulsion, with the modification that due to the presence of hexagonal boron nitride gates above and below the graphene, it is cut off at large distances. So the important part here is that the strength of the Coulomb interaction is very strong, that it's 5 or maybe 10 times stronger than the kinetic energy. And so we expect that we're in a regime where really interaction dominated. So in other words, what I've written here is very close to what Anderson calls the theory of almost everything. It's a band structure plus extremely strong electron-electron interactions. And we are going to ask ourselves, can we actually compute the ground state of this model? Okay, just like to pause, see if anyone has any questions, if people are happy with the setup. I don't hear anything, so I will proceed. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to do a series of reductions to the model so that I can simplify it a little bit without altering the physics and without making any drastic changes, but making it possible to actually solve it. So the first issue is that we have far too many degrees of freedom. We have 10,000 fermions per unit cell, and that's really not a feasible number to deal with numerically. So our first step is to project into the flat bands. You can see them indicated here in red, and you can see that they're well separated from the so-called remote bands. What this means is that projecting to the flat bands is going to be a good low energy effective theory, and it will be perturbatively valid to do this. So once we do this projection, we've reduced the number of degrees of freedom down to 8 per unit cell, which is much more manageable. And just to count them up, there's 2 from bands and then 4 from internal degrees of freedom, the K and K prime valleys, and then spin up and down. So we've reduced to 8 degrees of freedom per unit cell. The next step that one usually wants to take when you try to do numerics is to have a lattice model. Recall that the interacting BM model that I defined is going to be defined only as free fermions in the continuum in the mini Brillouin zone. And so the straightforward thing to do is to Fourier transform and work with the 1EA localized orbitals. Unfortunately, there is a topological obstruction to doing this, that in a series of recent papers, it's been shown that you cannot have both 2D localized 1EA orbitals as well as a local action of the two most important symmetries in the model. And this means that we're going to have to give up at least some parts of this to move forward. So one option that people have worked with is to use so-called, is to give up on the local action of the symmetry, in which case you not only have long-range Coulomb interactions, but also long-range symmetry actions, and you get these fidget spinner-like orbitals. The issue with that is that if you're trying to do numerics on finite size, then the long-range nature of the symmetry action means that the symmetry will necessarily be broken by your finite size cutoff. It then becomes a very delicate game to determine if you have actual symmetry breaking in the model, And frankly, that's something that we didn't want to have to deal with. It makes it very tricky. So unfortunately, we can't proceed with this solution. Another possibility is that since the topology is fragile, you can increase the number of fermions from 8 to 20 and thereby avoid the obstruction, but at the cost of greatly increasing the number of degrees of freedom you have. Unfortunately, 20 fermions is actually too much for us, so we can't do that solution either. And then the question becomes, is there something better we can do if we want to do DMRG with this? The answer that we have settled on is 1D 1EA localization. Instead of finding 2D 1EA orbitals, we instead localize along the x direction, but keep things periodic along y. So here's an example of two of these hybrid 1EA orbitals. They are localized in x, but periodic in y. And this is the basis we are going to choose to use. By doing this 1D localization, we avoid the topological obstruction, and we can have a local symmetry action as well as local orbitals, aside from periodicity. Just to comment on our labeling for a second, this is going to be our basis. So we have ky indexed in a 1D Brillouin zone, then n will be our position in the x direction, and finally plus minus will be a churn label. So you can figure out that the bands have churn number plus or minus one, and therefore so did the 1A orbitals associated to them, and we'll make use of that fact later. Okay, so we do hybrid 1A localization, and let's see what that does geometrically. Here's our mini Brillouin zone where our model is defined, and we're going to take a finite number of momentum cuts through that. So on each one of these cuts, we are going to Fourier transform, and these momenta k points are going to turn into this row of 1A orbitals. The next cut through will turn into the next row of 1A orbitals, and so on and so forth. Then we can snake through this cylinder to find our quasi 1D system where DMRG can be performed. And just as a reminder, inside each site, we have internal degrees of freedom like the churn index and spin and Valley degrees of freedom as well. So let's put that all together. Here's the sequence of things we've done. We've started from the non-interacting BM model and added Coulomb interactions, very strong. We project to the flat bands and finally Fourier transform to take us to the cylinder. By looking at a few finite momentum cuts, we've reduced this to a quasi 1D model where in principle you can run DMRG. You can just put this model into a DMRG library such as TenPy by our own Johannes Hauschild and press go, and it will in principle spit out the ground state. I should also mention that a very similar work has been done recently. Kong and Vafek have a fantastic recent paper where they did DMRG not on an infinite cylinder but instead on a finite length cylinder, and their results will be fairly similar to ours with a very important caveat that DMRG converges very badly due to finite size effects. So you really need to go to this infinite cylinder to actually be able to securely identify what the physics is that's going on here. Okay. So we have now our model. In principle, we can do DMRG, but only in principle. In practice, there's actually a very large problem here. And that gets back to the bond dimension that I discussed earlier. Recall that the bond dimension is how complex our model is, and DMRG is going to scale like the bond dimension squared. Unfortunately, our cylinder model has a humongous bond dimension. And let me show the origin of that. So if you have long-range interactions, which we do, we don't have algebraic interactions, but we still do have interactions which are significant at 10 or even 15 unit cells away. So if you have an interaction at a distance delta x in 2D, then in the 1D, quasi 1D system, it gets blown up into 8ly times that distance. And the bond dimension goes like that squared. So if you churn through all the numbers, you'll find that the full bond dimension of the Hamiltonian is size 230,000. And as the DMRG experts around will tell you, this is too much. This is just unmanageable. So here's a little bit of context to that number. If I just go through some other models which people have done DMRG with, for the icing model, the MPO bond dimension is 3. The XXZ model, it's going to be 4. A long range icing model with power law interactions might be 10 or 20. And a 2D Heisenberg model might be 40 to 100. So we are up here at 230,000 orders of magnitude bigger than anything that people normally deal with, and far beyond the practical limit for what you can actually do on most computers. So this is a real issue and a big wrench in the works. Our solution here, our special secret sauce, is this idea of MPO compression, that we are going to use a new MPO compression algorithm we have invented to reduce the bond dimension of the MPO down to a very manageable level without sacrificing accuracy or precision of the ground state. So very unusually, what we're finding here is that most of the work in this project goes into computing what is the right model to solve. And then once you have that model, this compressed model that I'll tell you about, then doing DMRG is essentially straightforward. It's using very standard tools. So this is our method for simulating bilayer graphing. Start with the BM model, add the Coulomb interactions, go to a 1D cylinder, do this all-important compression, and finally run standard DMRG. So any questions here?
Maybe a basic question. Where sure. you detect the lattice rotational symmetry?
Sorry, say again, please.
Where you detect the lattice rotational symmetry?
Yes, I'll comment on symmetries at the end. Most of the important symmetries are going to be local on-site symmetries, except for C3, which we will deal with in another way.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Okay, I will then go on and spend about 5 or 10 minutes on matrix product operators and how you compress them. This will be a little bit more towards the tensor network end of things, and then I will return to good old-fashioned solid-state physics in about 10 minutes. So let me take one slide to briefly define or remind you of what a matrix product operator is. And for this, we'll go to the setting of 1D spin chains. So for an example, I've given a icing model plus an extra ZXZ interaction. Here, X, Y, and Z are, of course, Pauli matrices. So in this Hamiltonian, every term in it is an infinite Pauli string with identities all the way to the left. Then you place some operators and then identities all the way to the right. And to write this Hamiltonian out, and you have to place these Pauli strings, at every possible position. So what a matrix product operator is a tool that places one more site of the operator. It sort of marches across from left to right, placing the sites one by one. And here it is for this, the case of this Hamiltonian. So what you do is you start from the initial node and you go through to the final node. And one path might be that you start with the initial node, you pass any you place any arbitrary number of identities, then you might place an X and then another X, then identities after that. So that will create a string like this or like any of these. Another option, of course, would be to start with the identity and then place X, then Z, and then X again. And this would place one of these other sorts of strings. So this graph here is one way of viewing a matrix product operator. Another is as a matrix. You can convert the graph to a matrix, which will be operator valued. And this will encode the same information that by multiplying these matrices together repeatedly, you can reproduce this entire Hamiltonian. And the bond dimension of our Hamiltonian is nothing other than the size of this matrix. It's a 5x5 matrix, so this is bond dimension 5. You can also count out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different nodes on here. Okay, so that, in a nutshell, is what a matrix product operator is. The problem that we want to look at today is how to compress them. Given a Hamiltonian, what is the optimal matrix product operator which represents it? Which is to say, what is the smallest bond dimension I can get away with? And if we take our same example from the last slide, here's a way to do it with bond dimension 5, and here's a way to do it with bond dimension 4. So clearly, you know, this is our target. We want to be able to say, given this Hamiltonian, write down this matrix product operator instead of this one. And I'll just comment on the literature a little bit. For the finite case where you have a finite system, then this problem is essentially already solved. And the iTensor library actually has an excellent auto MPO function for doing this completely automatically. For the infinite case, however, things are somewhat more involved, more complicated, and you really have to think about what a local operator means and what extra structure that has. So this is in some work I did with Sheng Yu Kao and Mike Zalatel last year, and we came up with an answer, which I will summarize on this slide. So in practice, what you have is you have some algorithm for actually finding the compressed MPO. I won't go through that, but I'm very happy to take questions from DMRG experts at the end or now. Let me just instead comment on one of the key ideas that goes in, which is that you need to use a Schmidt decomposition that respects locality. So you cannot do the thing you do for matrix product states and just use a normal Schmidt decomposition. You instead need to take into account the locality structure of the operator and modify what a Schmidt decomposition should be. Once you have such a modified Schmidt decomposition and you expand your operator in terms of small singular values, then you can simply cut those off and get a good approximation for your operator. You can also show various useful results, such as that compressed operators have ground state properties very similar to the original operator. So if I compress an operator, then the new ground state energy will be very similar to the old ground state energy. The phase will be very similar. All observables will be similar. So the upshot, therefore, is that for any given matrix product operator, we can compute a low bond dimension approximation to it using this algorithm. Here's how this works in practice for bilayer graphing, that if we start with our bond dimension 230,000 operator, we can press it all the way down to 1,000 and have no more than 1% error in any observable. You can also see that as you increase the bond dimension that we allow ourselves in the final compressed operator, then this approximation will get more and more accurate. So the ground error in the ground state energy, the error in observables, the error in the fidelity will all decrease quite quickly. So this is the technique that we use to go from the unusable bond dimension down to a reasonable one where we can actually run DMRG. Okay, so that is our MPO compression technique. I'd like to pause again for questions.
I have a question this time. So if you look at the figures you had in the previous slide, then if you did sort of the more naive approach to compression where you like write the two physical legs for the MPO together and then you compress it like an MPS, how would these figures look different?
So that technique can actually fail very badly. It turns out that if you look at the singular values, then A few of them are extensive, they scale with system size, and the rest do not. If you do the normal Schmidt decomposition, then the extensive and intensive spaces are mixed together. And so sometimes you're actually making an extensive error when you truncate with the normal Schmidt values. So you can actually make a, you know, an infinite error if you do the normal technique and not the locality respecting one. In practice, it often seems to be fine, but we don't really know when it fails and doesn't fail. So it seems that there's how do I say this? You run the risk of having large uncontrolled errors if you do something directly analogous to states. Does that answer it?
Yeah, that's great. And I think Eric has a question.
Yeah, I have one question. Can you go back one more slide?
Yes.
Is it possible to understand the scaling of epsilon with some your parameter, for example, system size? I mean, does epsilon, just trying to understand, I mean, does sum over SA square, does it, and you say it is small, but in what, parametrically, in what parameter is it small?
Right. So epsilon is intensive. It does not scale with system size. Mm-hmm. Epsilon is actually a choice here that I choose where to truncate this sum, mm-hmm. and I can choose where to truncate it so that my error will be small. There is no, how do I say this? The distribution of these singular values is different for every operator, but almost mm-hmm. always it falls off exponentially.
I see.
If you have longer range operators, then it will fall off, you know, with power law interactions, then it will fall off less quickly, but it will still fall off very quickly. So in practice, just a few hundred or 1,000 singular values should be enough for anyone.
I see. So the one possibility is if there are two low-lying states, one is ground state, other is some other phase of matter, some first order right. transition, then you can miss that.
Yes.
If, because this energy is order exactly, one.
Yes. So if you have, you know, yeah. So if you have ground state energy crossing
right.
here,
yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, right.
Then in the exact vicinity of the transition, then you'll have a little bit of uncertainty. You might move the position of the transition around, mm-hmm. but away from that, you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you take a smaller epsilon, then you could zero in on that.
Right.
On the other hand, away from the transition, you'll never mistake these two. They'll shift a little right. bit, maybe, right. but yeah. So it's pretty secure.
Yeah.
Great. And we're able to make, as you can see, very precise estimates for what our accuracy and precision should be.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Other thoughts, other comments?
Just want to make sure that I understand. So you said that the singular values falls exponentially fast. Is that
yeah.
because the Hamiltonian is local in space?
So let's see. I'm being a little bit a little inaccurate. It doesn't actually fall off as an exponential. It falls off as fast as an exponential. I can't tell you. The Hamiltonian is too complicated for me to be able to tell you what goes into the specific singular value spectrum we see. This is not quite the singular value spectrum here, but it tracks quite closely with it. Let me see if I can see this. Longer range interactions mean it will decay more slowly, and we do indeed have fairly long interactions, so it does decay relatively slowly relative to many other systems. I can't speak for certain about I can't predict just from looking at the Hamiltonian written down what the singular value spectrum will be, but it's this is sort of the worst case scenario in many ways.
I see. So, you know, for MPS, the singular value is related to the entanglement entropy, whether it's a volume law or area of all. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering whether for MPO you get something similar
Yes. So you do, you get, there's something called the operator state entanglement entropy. There's this wonderful series of papers from, for instance, Jerome Dubail, who looked at this in all sorts of systems. And there's a close connection between minimal operator entanglement entropy and the sort of truncation that we're doing. The twist to that, again, is that that notion of operator entanglement doesn't take locality into account, and you really need locality. You want, right, that the cardinal mistake we're trying to avoid is truncating our Hamiltonian in a way that we lose locality. We really want this to be a local Hamiltonian at the end. So yes, there's a close connection to operator entanglement.
I see, thanks.
All right. Other questions? Okay. Let me then proceed. And for the last 20 minutes or so, whatever it is, I will tell you about what we learned about the physics of bilayer graphene. So just to set the stage here, I will restrict us to the spinless one valley case at half filling. And this is not a necessary restriction, both numerically and conceptually we can lift this later on, but I'll focus on this case just because it's a little bit simpler and because we can compare with other things in the literature here. So we use 6 momentum cuts across the mini Brillouin zone, whose positions can be adjusted. We can scan them vertically. And for each cut, we Fourier transform, we get our 1A orbitals, we then get our quasi-1D system, and we get a effective cylinder of radius 12 to do our DMRG. Then, as someone was asking about earlier, we can write down local symmetry actions for this basis, the most important of which is the C2T symmetry. So it is a rotation about Y followed by time reversal. And it's going to flip the churn bands, importantly. One thing which we can't represent well is C3 symmetry because we've taken a rectangular Brillouin zone, but it should only be broken very slightly.
Question?
Yes, please.
Once your system size is larger, now you are using this 1D linear space. Does this? So how does C3 act on the 1D one-year space?
It acts in a sort of horrible non-local way. So when we have to deal with C3 later, we'll actually do something a little different.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks.
Okay. All right. So this is our basis and this is our symmetries. I want to comment very quickly on what observables we're going to look at before I show the results. So inside each orbital, we have the plus and minus churn fermions. And so our main observable is going to be the spin diagonal, the K diagonal two-point function, which I'll arrange into a 2x2 matrix like this. So we could write this out in terms of Pauli matrices. We could parameterize it in terms of Pauli matrices. And let me just show you how to interpret one of these. If I have gamma z equals 1, that means that I'm totally polarized into the churn plus orbital at that k point. Whereas if I have gamma z equals minus 1, then I'm totally polarized into the minus orbital. And as I just mentioned, C2T is going to flip my churn labels so that if I have C2T symmetry, then gamma z will be exactly 0. So I'll be restricted to the C2T symmetric plane. Another special case is that if I have 1 electron per momentum point, then I'm going to be on the unit sphere, and I can use spherical coordinates to represent the observables we care about here. Okay. So these are our observables, and here are the DMRG results. So there's a lot here. Let me break it down for you. What I'm doing is I'm burying the coupling burying the tunneling coupling. So in the AA stacking regions versus the AB stacking regions, you have different tunneling rates between the layers of graphene, and we're just making this an adjustable parameter. If W naught equals zero down here, then this is actually an analytically solvable limit called the chiral limit. And the realistic value is something like here, something like 0.85. So our low W naught, so clearly we have two phases here, a low W naught phase and a high W naught phase. At low W naught, we have a finite value of gamma Z, so C2T must be broken. And in fact, we're almost fully polarized here, which means that our state is very close to a product state where we've only populated the churn plus orbital. Because of that, we can identify this as a quantum anomalous Hall state. And this actually is exactly what you find in the analytics at omega naught equals zero. So with very high confidence, we can say that this is quantum anomalous Hall up to here. At high omega naught over omega one, which is the physically realistic situation, the phase is much more involved. One thing which is straightforward is that C2T is preserved. You can see that the C2T order parameter vanishes. And so we do have that symmetry. Before we actually go on to identify which phase this is, I want to tell you about a very surprising and remarkable result that we found, which is that Hartree-Fock is essentially exact here. So let me first describe the plot. We're restricted to the C2T symmetric plane, and we are restricted to the unit circle. So everything is described by the dynamics of 5k. And here is 5k over the mini Brillouin zone computed on a 30 by 30 grid in Hartree-Fock. And then here I have a comparison between Hartree-Fock and DMRG where I take six cuts through the Brillouin zone at whose positions are scanned up and down. So as you can clearly see by eye, these match basically exactly, that Hartree-Fock and DMRG give us the same answer to within 1 or 2%. And the DMRG ground state is going to be a Slater determinant, plus small corrections. I think this is really, really wild, honestly, that despite putting in interactions 5 or 10 times the kinetic energy scale, we still find that we have a Slater determinant at the end of the day. So, question?
Yeah, I have two basic questions. Are you at
half filling? Yes.
And I guess I don't quite understand what you mean by restricting to gamma z equal to zero. You mean in the Hartree-Fock treatment you restrict, or do you mean even in DMRG you also do that restriction?
Even in DMRG. So here I am showing DMRG observables. Let me just go back to the definition for a second. So gamma z is measuring is the value of the polarization between the churn plus and churn minus bands. And it is these are DMRG observables or Hartree-Fock observables, whichever I like. And here in both DMRG or Hartree-Fock, you can see that their value is essentially the same.
Wait, I guess I don't quite understand what you mean by restricting it to zero.
I can't hear you.
I said I'm a bit confused what you mean by restricting gamma z to zero.
Right. So at large W naught over W1, where we're in this phase, you can see that gamma z is restricted to be zero, that because we have C2T symmetry, gamma z must vanish.
I think the confusion is that it sounded like you were saying that you, in your setup of the computation, set the gamma z must be zero, but that's not the case. You're just that you're
sorry. No, yeah, it is the other way around. Yes, we do the computation and find the gamma z is zero.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. Right. Similarly, we do the computation and find that we are restricted to the unit circle, so that phi of k is the only observable that matters for two-point functions, that phi of k describes everything that's going on. So I have not made any extra assumptions here. We take our model, we do Hartree-Fock on it directly in K-space, or we do DMRG on it as I've described, and we find that they're the same. So aside from this being very striking, we can actually use this as a very convenient tool to be able to analyze what this phase is at high W-naught. And here's one part of that. So the first thing you can do is you can show that it is a nematic phase that picks out a preferred orientation. I don't particularly want to go through the details of this, but you can show that at high symmetry points, then C3 will have a particular action, and that action is not what you actually see in the state, that it is violated very strongly. This is something in the Hartree-Fock numerics. So even though we're still on this rectangular Bilois zone, it's only broken very slightly. And so we can conclude that this is indeed a nematic phase with broken C3. That is our first bit of identification here. The other thing we can conclude is that this is a phase with Dirac points. So if we compute these Wilson loops that I've indicated, then we will see that both of them are quantized to plus pi. And it is a standard fact that if you have a Wilson loop quantized to plus pi, then there must be one Dirac node enclosed. So we must have two Dirac nodes total. They both have the same chirality, so they cannot meet each other and annihilate through any small perturbation. So we must have a semi-metallic phase. And again, this shows up in both Hartree-Fock and DMRG. If I look at Hartree-Fock, I can look at the band gap. And here it is. You can see that it's getting very small in the middle. If I just take a vertical cut here, then plot the inverse band gap, you can see that it is, that the inverse band gap is diverging, signaling gaplessness. Whereas in DMRG, if I take my horizontal cuts and I scan them vertically, then when I pass through these points, I find that my correlation length diverges. And a diverging correlation length in DMRG heralds gaplessness, and so is another sign of these Dirac nodes. So both Hartree-Fock and DMRG are telling us that this is a nematic phase breaking C3, and it also has a pair of Dirac nodes, both with the same chirality.
Question?
Yes, please.
With interactions, suppose the ground state is far away from the Hartree-Fock state, as this Wilson loop makes sense?
Sorry, I can't hear you very well. Say again, please.
In the interacting system where the ground state is far away from a Hartree-Fock state, as this Wilson loop makes sense in predicting topological properties?
Let me show the next slide and then come back to your question.
Okay.
So I'll start with the end of the slide first. Here's our sort of schematic for how things are. Our DMRG ground state is in the space of many body states, but it's very close to this space, to the subspace of Slater determinate states. And so here's DMRG and here's Hartree-Fock. When I'm measuring those Wilson loops, I'm actually working in the Hartree-Fock state right here, but this is close enough that it still makes sense to talk about Wilson loops and other such notions, even though I'm in a many-body state, right? That this is a perturbatively small change. So hopefully that gets to your question. So when I compute these single particle things, I'm actually computing down here, but it's so close that it should apply to the actual state, in qualitatively, if not precisely.
But conceptually, suppose but it's far away from the hard fork state, I guess.
Yeah. If we were over here, then we would, then this would not work.
Okay. Thanks.
Yes. Right. So that is, yeah, that is an important fact that we are so close to Slater determinant physics that we can pretend that our DMRG ground state is a Slater determinant and be pretty much correct. One thing that we have to be careful of, though, is that there's another semi-metal around, and we don't want to get confused with that. That if I look at just the non-interacting BM model without Coulomb interactions, then that ground state is also a semi-metal, and it also has Dirac nodes, but that is a different semi-metal. The BM ground state has Dirac nodes near K and K prime, and they're pinned there, whereas we had Dirac nodes near gamma. And furthermore, we had C3 broken, whereas the BM ground state does not. So if you look at the trace distance, for instance, between these two states, you'll find that it's very large, and that there's not a whole lot of resemblance between the ground state for the BM model versus the ground state that we find in DMRG, except that they're both semi-metals. So another way to say it is that if you start from the BM ground state and if you did perturbation theory around that by adding in the interaction slowly, you probably wouldn't get to the DMRG ground state, even though it's only has a small distance from the Slater determinant states. Okay.
So is the gamma point a high symmetry point?
Gamma is high symmetry, yes.
On the C3, right?
Yes.
C3 is broken?
Yes.
So in principle, this Dirac node can move a little bit?
Sorry, again?
In principle, this Dirac node can move away from gamma?
The gapless points are slightly away from gamma.
Uh-huh. Okay. And there's also, I think there's some reflection symmetry or some other symmetry. Are the Dirac nodes on the high symmetry line of that symmetry?
Yes, so they are on the y-axis here. This is why I'm calling it pneumatic semi-metal sub y. I think that is, as far as I can tell, that is not universal. That is just an artifact of our hexagonal Brillouin zone. If you had a real hexagonal Brillouin zone, then you'd be able to get, you know, all three types of, or all, yeah, all three possible orientations of the Dirac nodes near gamma, probably.
So just in your setup, is this y direction a high symmetry line?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's enough to figure out which of the C3 ground states you'll have. Yeah. Okay, so that's my story for you today. That just to recap quickly, I've told you about how our new compression procedure enables you to do DMRG for bilayer graphene. I've told you about how in the single valley spinless case, we have a transition from quantum anomalous Hall to semi-metallic states. And I've told you how, quite incredibly, there is a very, very close relation between Hartree-Fock and the DMRG ground states through this entire system. So this is certainly not the end of the line here. We have a bunch of work that's in the pipeline. Even as we speak, a supercomputer is computing DMRG for two valleys and the spinful case. We're also looking at excitations and strain and other moray systems, and hopefully in the end, that holy grail trying to figure out what the mechanism is for superconductivity. So with that, thank you very much for your time, and I'd be more than happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Dan, for the talk. Everyone can, use the Zoom reactions or whatever.
Thank you.
It's a very great talk. So yes, if there's any questions, and I guess we have Dan's finished in plenty of time, so plenty of time for questions.
I had a couple of questions. Can I ask?
Yes, please.
So the transition, I was trying to understand the transition from the pneumatic semi-metal to the I guess the other phase is an anomalous quantum Hall.
Yes.
So that doesn't look like us. I mean, it's not something just free fermion transition in a sense, because there are order parameters. I mean, I'm just getting confused. So the are there two order parameters vanishing at the same point? I can, if I think in the order parameters, are both the anomalous, right. If I think of the time reversal, is time reversal getting restored at the transition from the anomalous Hall side, and from the other side, is the nematic getting restored? I mean, the rotational symmetry getting restored.
Several comments on the transition. One, due to the phenomena I mentioned earlier, DMRG does not converge very near to the transition. So you can see that gray bar in the diagram there. DMRG does not converge there. And so we cannot say there's many things we cannot say about the transition. Mm-hmm. We expect it to be first order between these two phases, one of which has C2T symmetry, but broken C3, and the other which has broken C2T.
I see. Did you try to think about, is there a possibility of a deconfined quantum criticality, or is it ruled out by some arguments?
We have stayed away from considering it because one, it's not clear what's going on there. It does seem like it could be something very strange, though it seems like first order is the most likely. We've not ruled out anything because in the case where you add valley and spin back in, then this transition goes away and you actually get no transition at all. So it's a interesting transition, but it's a non-physical transition that you can't realize experimentally. And so we haven't focused on it.
What do you mean it goes away when you put it back? What happened? Sorry, can you say it more?
Right. So there's, how do I say this? When you add back in valley and spin symmetry, then there's a series of predictions in the literature that the ground state should be the so-called Cramer's intervalley coherent state as a function of, for all W naught values, that there shouldn't be any transition at all. And this is, for instance, in Eslam Khalaf's papers in the last few years.
I see.
So we suspect that having a transition here at all is a artifact of only taking a single value.
I see.
So it didn't hurt. It didn't seem that important. And I'm not saying it's not interesting. I'm saying we didn't focus there.
So the order parameter doesn't converge.
It could be an exotic transition.
So you're saying even the order parameter doesn't converge very well close to transition. Or if I just plot two order parameters, everything is large error or something. Not just like
in time. There's large errors there. Yeah.
I see. And other maybe small question, maybe I can ask, feel free to answer it later before other people have questions, because it's maybe somewhat unrelated. Is this compression technique, is it also useful for doing quantum dynamics? Because that's also requires large bond dimension, and one of the bottlenecks is often just that.
That was our original impetus for it. We had that married with our operator growth in Krylov space technique. And it could be useful there. I think there's probably better techniques in practice, but probably there's something useful to be done with it there, yeah.
I see. Okay, thank you. I think that was all.
All right. Other folks?
Can I go back to previous slide?
Sure. This one?
So if starting from BM, if you turn on a perturbation that breaks C3 rotation symmetry, can you tune it to this pneumatic metal without any phase transition?
So it's a little bit... it sort of depends what you mean by phase transition, because then I would think that this is going, I could draw a line from here to here through the space of Slater determinants, and I could first break C3 and then draw a line after that. And you could connect them, you know, adiabatically, but phase transition has to be defined very carefully because all of these are gapless states.
Well, for gapless state, so, right, you can
so
still...
So you have direct nodes. Yeah.
Yeah, still define it.
So, I think that is probably correct. We have not done this, but probably once you add a C3 breaking term, it would be unsurprising if it's adiabatically connected to this current state.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about some DMRG stuff quickly. So you talked about the MPO bond dimensions, but so I guess
right.
I feel like the ground state is pretty close to the state determinant. So I guess, maybe talk about like what are the MPS bond dimensions you need and then how that changes when you add the value and spin from what you know so far.
Yeah. So we're very lucky that on this side of things, we're basically at a product state. And so our max entanglement is like 2 and we need bond dimension 100. Mm-hmm. On this side, the entanglements, you can show that you'll have exactly 6 Bell pairs in the semi-metal state for this. And so you'll have very reasonable entanglement there as well. And by 1,000, everything is totally converged. Once you have valiant spin, then things get much more tricky. For something like the Cramer's intervalley coherent state or for superconductivity, you expect these to manifest as, these are things states that try to spontaneously break a U1 symmetry. And to capture those in 1D where you cannot break the U1 symmetry, they will manifest as algebraic long range order as you've dealt with in your previous work. And for that, you do indeed need very large bond dimensions. So, I don't know, 2,000, 4,000, 10,000, who knows? Okay. Might be bad. So that's another reason why we stuck to this simple case here, because everything is very well converged. We don't have to worry about have we gone to large enough bond dimensions? We're sure that we have. Mm-hmm. All right.
I had one more question, if there are no
please,
no
yes. One else.
About does this way of thinking in terms of this interesting Vanier states here, localizing only along one direction, does it give any insight into why it's a Hartree-Fock state? Do you get any new insight why it looks so much like a Slater determinant?
So I think that there are ways of seeing conceptually why it might be like a Slater determinant. I think the choice of 1EA functions doesn't particularly help. So I think our choice of 1EA functions should best be regarded just as a choice of basis that we could have used any choice of basis. This was just convenient for our purposes to avoid the topological obstruction. Mm-hmm. The best explanation I've heard put forward so far for why we get something so close to Hartree-Fock ground state is as follows. And this is, this is still somewhat mysterious to me. I'm going to share some intuition I heard from Aslam Khalif and maybe this will become more precise in months and years to come. If you take just the, let's see, where should I go? If you take just the interaction, if you turn off the kinetic energy, then you can argue that you should get a Hartree-Fock state because it's going to be a completely positive Hamiltonian. And you can find that Hartree-Fock states are going to be ground states there.
Mm-hmm. I see.
When you add back in the kinetic energy, it shouldn't change things too much because that's small and perturbative. And so you should get a something very close there. That's, I think, an argument and not a proof, but maybe the situation will improve.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. And about your earlier comment about breaking C3V and connecting it, don't you have to also break the time reversal acts in a different C2T? I mean, how can you connect two states which have different action of the
C2T? Right. I admit I don't know off the top of my head what symmetries the BM ground state has.
Okay. That's fine. Okay. Yeah, I should. I mean, I. Yeah,
someone would have to remind me.
Okay. That's fine. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Thank you. Thank you for your question.
Ground state. I think it has all the symmetries, right?
Sorry. Say again, please.
The BM ground state has all the symmetries. Right?
Okay. You may need a few transitions then. Sorry. We break C3, but we preserve C2T.
Yeah.
So yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you just have C2T, you can move the graph nodes around in the domain zone.
Yeah.
But there's also some reflection symmetries. I don't remember how they act.
There's MY or so-called C2 double prime, which has also a non-local action. I'm not sure how our state transforms under that. Though it's certainly known because there's various Hartree-Fock studies out there, and I think we can say that we can say now with confidence that even though it's only Hartree-Fock, we can say that those are almost certainly correct.
Okay, are there any other questions for Dan? If not, then let's all thank Dan again for the nice talk.